Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Emma Thompson talks to me about becoming an action hero in her 60s in the new gripping thriller Dead of Winter. I talk to the stars of the new Netflix series House of Guinness, Anthony Boyle and Danielle Galligan, about the drama of Stout. Plus, Chris Wasser reviews the much-talked-about new Paul Thomas Anderson movie, One Battle After Another. You can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're well, and I'm back to the whole of my health after being a little under the weather last week, and one or two of you sent vaguely sarcastic emails about man flu, but I took them on the chin. Took some paracetamol and raised a glass to President Trump. But that was all last week. I'm back to my full health this week and raring to go. And indeed, the big TV event of the week was obviously the finale of The Traitors. We talked about it briefly when it first landed. I said I thought it was really good. I said it wasn't a TV revolution or anything. But it is a TV revolution in sorts that the viewing figures were off the charts, and so many people were watching live TV, which I was delighted about. And, you know, I watched every episode and most of my family did as well. And I said it at the start, but it was so well cast because all of the traitors, to a man, to a woman, they were all really nice people and they full of personality, but none of them were annoying and none of them were trying to eke out careers as TV stars, I don't think. They were just nice people. Like the airplane test, if you were stuck beside any of them on a long flight, would you be able to make conversation with them pleasantly? And you would. So I thought it was brilliantly cast. And it was very uniquely Irish. It had a real pleasant Irish flavour to it. So hats off to the national broadcaster for bringing it home with The Traitors Ireland, because it was very successful. And so say all of us. Well, I say it. So don't know what else anyone else is saying. Now, we're going to talk more TV later with the House of Guinness, but I do have to quickly mention that Slow Horses returned this week on Apple TV for season 5. Now, we can't get into what goes on in Slow Horses if you've never seen it. It's based on the novels, a series of books by a man called Mick Herron, all about a guy called Jackson Lamb, played brilliantly by Gary Oldman, overseeing a band of misfits and losers and boozers, as Mick Jagger has it in the theme song of the show. And it's this dissolute group of MI5 agents who were kind of put out to pasture and yet get involved in these serious, serious cases that involve murder and national security. It's back for season 5. Now, I only got to see one episode. I was sent a few, but I was having some technical issues with my Apple account or my Apple screening account. But anyway, but the first episode, you know, I thought was very good. It's more of the same, but for Slow Horses fans, I think that'll keep you very happy. In this one, it begins with a pretty chilling massacre when a gunman opens fire and shoots dead a campaigner for a London mayor who's running for election against a Conservative MP. And all sorts of things are set in place in episode 1. One of the great characters who's coming into play is the kind of tech geek in the office of Slow Horses, Roddy, played by Christopher Chung. He has a bigger part in it. And they're still reeling from the events of season 4, where all sorts of stuff went down. If you haven't seen Slow Horses, none of this will make any sense to you. If you have, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And I think season 5 so far, based on one episode, will keep you quite happy because Jackson Lamb, Gary Oldman, is back in full effect, hating everything he does, eating and drinking too much, being rude to people, but also being the smartest man in the room. I notice reviews are varying about it and some people are saying it's treading water or whatever, but I don't know. I think it's going to keep Slow Horses fans very happy. So that's Slow Horses, now back for season 5 on Apple TV. Now, we're going to start with movies this week and this.
Carl had an unusual request. He wanted his ashes to be scattered up north.
you're dead.
Hello? Anyone out there? It's an emergency. There's been a kidnapping. Anyone? Oh, hey there.
What are you doing up here?
Just a little fishing.
By yourself?
Yeah. See, you wouldn't happen to know where a Lake Hildar is, would you?
Yeah. Just back over the hill here.
Yes, now that was Emma Thompson in the cold Minnesota snowy landscape. She plays a good-natured Minnesota woman. Her recently deceased husband and her ran a fishing shop in this very kind of frozen place in Minnesota. And her husband took her on a fishing trip to this gorgeous remote lake on their first date. And we get flashbacks to that as she's on a mission to scatter his ashes on this lake. And she's on her way to this place and she gets into a bit of trouble with her car and stuff and she gets lost. And as you heard in the clip there, she's asking for directions to this lake. And she sees a splash of blood when she meets this man. And soon she realizes there's been a kidnapping. And there's a young girl played by Laura Marsden who's a prisoner in a basement. And this guy's clearly involved, and so is his very scary wife, played by Judy Greer. And what happens is we have Emma Thompson attempting to save this poor girl who's kidnapped in this basement for reasons that become very apparent. And Thompson's character, you know, she's not Sylvester Stallone, she's not a badass, but in a way, her knowledge of the cold and Minnesota and surviving in extreme cold gives her a kind of tenacity, and she becomes kind of gun-toting, not in a full Arnie Schwarzenegger mode, but she gets tough because she has to be. This is a real gripping thriller, and it's kind of reminiscent of a 1990s thriller, and I mean that completely as a compliment. It was shot in Finland, and it's not that that matters, but it's really cold looking. So it's a real icy thriller drama with Emma Thompson being great as this kind of reluctant, tough lady in it. So I got to talk to Emma Thompson about Dead of Winter. We spoke about a bit more besides, including the glorious Remains of the Day. The last time I spoke to her was 2 or 3 years ago for Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, when she was opposite Daryl McCormack, Irish actor, which was a great movie where she's playing this lady who goes to a male prostitute to, you know, get certain things. And so that was the last time I spoke to her. So I was delighted to talk to her again about Dead of Winter and a bit more. I'm not giving Emma Thompson an introduction. She's a legend, an Oscar-winning legend.
Hi, John. Nice to see you.
I spoke to you for Good Luck to You, Leo Grand. So it's nice to see you again. Unfortunately, this time you're not with an Irishman, but what can you do? I'll have to deal with what I have.
I know. Where is one when you need them, for crying out loud?
Well said. That might be my new ringtone. Tell me this. You know, a lazy headline could be Emma Thompson finally does action lead, but it is very action heavy. Like, I wasn't expecting it to be quite so. Was it the most intense physically role you think you've done, certainly in a long time?
In some ways, yes. I mean, Matilda, Nurse Trunchbull in Matilda was super, super intensely physical, but this was different because of the landscape we were in, you know, and I certainly have never done anything like this before. A thriller. I've never shot a gun or, you know, run on wet snow or fought with another person, female or male, on a frozen lake, 60 miles away from the Russian border. So, yeah, it was full of so many firsts.
Yeah. And, you know, there's no CGI as far as I could tell. It looked really cold. Was it very cold?
Yes, it was bloody cold. It was really, really cold. Colder than we get in Scotland, which is where I am, and Ireland. When I arrived, it was minus 27. So I got to Finland early. I got there a month early to To just get used to being cold, because you know where we were shooting on that frozen lake, there wasn't anything near it. There wasn't any buildings. There was no Winnebago or nice cozy hotel to go to. You just had to get through the days, and the crew were the same. You know, we so I put on that big costume, the great big kind of overall Carhartt style thing, and wore it for 4 weeks, you know, before we started shooting, just to kind of get able to stop thinking about being cold.
People don't realize what goes into making movies. That's all the practicalities of it on a metaphorical level, I suppose. Barb, you know, I said this is maybe you being an action hero or something like that, but I wonder, she's the smartest person in it and she's tough, but you know, she's not Sylvester Stallone. Is it saying something about, I don't know, tenacity is a superpower or something like that, that if you stick with it long enough, you can get through heavy duty things like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could say that. I mean, people have called her sort of the reluctant hero, but it seems to me that she's just doing what is essential under the circumstances. I mean, you wouldn't leave a girl in a cellar with those two people, and nor would I. We would probably die because we're not used to that kind of cold. But you know, the point is, I think that what she does is very human. And the fact that she succeeds in the way that she does, which is a form of success and a form of sacrifice, is because she's grown up in that landscape. And I think one of the things that I love most about her is the humble relationship and the very real relationship she has with nature. You know, that we're most of us are sort of cut off from nature, aren't we? We're not used to having to negotiate, navigate extreme weather. And she's used to it. So she knows how to mess people up. She knows that, you know, removing all sources of heat will really, really put a spanner in the works. You know, so you can see where it's all coming from. It's coming from practicalities that she's grown up with since she was little. You know, her grandmother saying to her, now don't you leave the house without your gloves because you know, you lose the use of your hands. That's the end of it. You lose your
That stuff
fingers. You
comes
lose your
back into
fingers.
play.
Yeah.
Tell me this. The problem with you and your career at this stage is now people like me have grown up with you. I hope that doesn't make you feel old and they
No,
get in
it makes
front
me
of
feel
you.
very proud.
Good, good. Well, the movie of all of yours that I've seen that spoke to me the most, because I remember seeing it as a teenager, was Remains of the Day. And to this day, the unrequited or the stilted or the life not lived love between you and Anthony Hopkins, even though you were the one trying to. Do you find people like me bring that up to you a lot? That if you look back over your whole career, that's the one I focused in on because it spoke to me as a teenager. Do you get that reaction? It's fine if you don't. You don't have to agree with me, but I wonder, does it recur a lot?
What happens is that every person, because it's been going on a long time, me making movies, you know, people are struck by something. You know how you pick up a book or you learn a word or you meet a person just at the time when you need it? You know, especially when you're a teenager, there are films and books and people that go it hit you at a very particular moment, and that's why it resonates. So for some people, it's Remains of the Day. For some people, it's Sense and Sensibility, or it's Love Actually, or it's bloody, you know, Nanny McPhee. People kind of get hit by certain. That's what I suppose. That's why I love the fact that I can keep changing up. Because then you never get caught in one moment. And what I'm glad you brought up Remains of the Day because it relates to the love story in Dead of Winter. Because you know that love story, that complete that really lived life, is one that it's much easier to let go of, isn't it?
Yeah,
It's all
absolutely.
right for her to say, "Skol, Carl. No, it's time to go, and I'll go with you."
Well, that's beautifully put. And I take it as a compliment that people like me are marking our lives out through the movies you've been in. You know, it's meant to be as a compliment, not to aid you.
No, not at all. And I'm very proud and glad that I'm
So
still
you should
making
be.
movies at 66. Oh, that just made me cry. Thank you.
Oh dear. Oh dear. I didn't mean to do that.
No, that's fine. It's good for me.
Can I tell people I made Emma Thompson cry? Is that
Oh, go on. Yes.
can I go into the
Like
day and
sob,
say
you know,
that?
like in Love Actually, you know, she just wouldn't stop. Just sobbing.
Oh dear. I'm out of time. It was lovely to meet you again. Continue to
test. Yeah, it's lovely to see you too, babe. Have a great day.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Emma Thompson there, who I made cry, but hopefully not in a bad way. I think it was when I said to her, people were marking their lives out by certain movies that she'd made, seemed to get her welled up slightly. I could actually see her tearing up because we were on Zoom together. What a delightful lady. And her new film, Dead of Winter, is great. Delight's the wrong word because it's a gripping, harrowing drama at times, but a really good watch. And she's great as a reluctant badass in it at times, and though remains sweet. And it's kind of heartfelt as well. There's a gorgeous relationship with her husband, Carl, in it. So that was Emma Thompson talking about Dead of Winter, which I should say is in cinemas now from this Friday, the 26th of September. So do check it out. Up next, we enter the House of Guinness. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, the big TV event of the week is this.
In the letter of proposal, I think it was made clear what kind of marriage we are offering.
A mariage blanc.
What is your understanding of that expression?
It means if you were to choose me, we would marry. And I would take your name. But I will not be obliged to take your...
Arthur, perhaps we could speak for a moment in private.
Exactly that, Olivia. A mariage blanc is a marriage in form, but not in function.
Without being indelicate, you will still be at liberty to function in other places.
We are rather getting ahead of ourselves.
I will, from time to time, function in other places.
Yes, that was Anthony Boyle playing Arthur Guinness. And you heard his soon-to-be wife there, Lady Olivia Charlotte Hedges White, I believe her full name is, played by Danielle Galligan, organising a marriage of convenience, let's say, a lavender marriage, as some people describe it, because Arthur Guinness, in this telling of this Guinness story, was gay. So he was coming to a kind of marriage of convenience in 1860s Dublin. You've probably heard about the House of Guinness. There's been a lot of press and coverage of it. It's all about the House of Guinness, the Guinness family in the 1860s, where Sir Benjamin Guinness dies, and this has far-reaching consequences for his four adult children, Arthur, Edward, Anne, and Ben, as well as a group of Dublin characters who work for the Guinnesses and people who are involved in this time in 1860s Dublin and Ireland. It was created and written by Stephen Knight, the man who gave us Peaky Blinders. And some people are suggesting this is kind of Succession with Guinness with a touch of Peaky Blinders. And that's quite accurate. And what we have is a succession drama, I suppose, where his four children are struggling, come to terms with what his death means. And Arthur, played by Anthony Boyle, as I mentioned, and Edward, played by Louis Partridge, in essence, become the people who look after the brewery. Arthur, as you heard there, is kind of aristocratic. He's a conservative. He's en route to a title, and he kind of doesn't even want to be in Ireland, wants to live in London, but he's brought home by all this and begins a marriage of convenience, as I say. James Norton is in this as a guy called Rafferty, who's kind of the fixer for the Guinness family. So there's also lots going on about Irish history and links to Fenians, links to British Parliament, taking the Guinness trip to America. Now, the reviews of this, I noticed the English press are loving it. The Irish press are a bit more circumspect about some of the historical flourishes, let's call them, maybe some of the accents. I think on the whole, though, this is pretty entertaining TV. A lot of money has been spent on it. It looks great. There's a compelling family drama here, very much in the style of Succession. There's a lot of Irish actors in it as well, and chief among them are the aforementioned Anthony Boyle, who plays Arthur Guinness. He was great last year in that Disney show Say Nothing, where he played this IRA guy, the Dark, as he was called. I remember him vividly in that. He was in the movie Tolkien. He was in the TV show Masters of Air. He wears a great moustache in this, I have to say, as Arthur Guinness. Danielle Galligan plays Lady Olivia Hedges. She's an outspoken, charming woman from a kind of dissolute, aristocratic family, and she's trying to make her way in the world and realizes hitching her post to Arthur is a clever thing to do. And her story goes in interesting ways after she marries Arthur. She's played by Danielle Galligan, who was in Obituary in RTE last year. And she was opposite Aina Hardwick for the movie Lakelands, which we talked about last year. So both Danielle and Anthony Boyle, playing Sir Arthur Guinness, both came into studio earlier in the week, and we had a chat about the House of Guinness. And I'm delighted to say that Danielle and Anthony both joined me in studio. Guys, hello.
Hello.
How you doing? Are you?
Anthony, I'm slightly disappointed. I'm sorry to start so fashionably. Where's the tash gone?
Well, I'd love to have the tash 24/7. It makes me feel very virile. It makes me really enjoy life a little bit more. I like when you're drinking a Guinness and you sort of have that wee cream and you lick it off. One of the peak joys in life. But I'm playing Sam Bankman-Fried right now, who was a crypto kind of billionaire guy, and he was unfortunately clean shaven. So I'm sorry that you're seeing my bare face today. I can only apologise.
It's a fine bare face.
I'll take it.
Go bare face. I'll take it. Sam Bankman-Fried, we'll get into that in a minute, but we should talk about Guinness. Danielle, your character, you could say she's a mercenary. She identifies Arthur, you know, this is the ticket to the top. But the more goes on, we realise, you know, she has her own traumas and she's trying to put right. How do you see her?
She's so multifaceted to me. I think mercenary is a really interesting word to use. I would definitely agree with that. I think also she has a lot of, a really strong sense of her own innate self-worth. So although she sees Arthur as her ticket to the top, I think she's also aware of what she brings to the table. It's a very symbiotic relationship that they have. He needs legitimacy and nobility, which she brings because she's an aristocrat. And then she needs cash because she wants to live the high life, you know? And I think as well, she's very honest. She's very smart, intelligent, ambitious, strategic. But I think that she just underestimates her own kind of need for love and capacity for love. And I think that's where she kind of gets tripped up, because she really does fall for Arthur in a platonic way. Like, they become very close friends. So although she wants to push him to the top so that she can ride his coattails, she also wants to like protect him, keep him safe like a friend. And then she falls head over heels for someone that is really unsuitable. And like, you know, like Icarus, she kind of flies too close to the sun a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We nearly gave a spoiler there, but we didn't.
No.
Mm-hmm. Netflix are in the room, so we need to be careful.
Don't worry.
Netflix have a knife out right now in the corner of the room, pointing it at Danielle Galligan.
Danielle's been taken out the back and told to look across the river.
And Anthony, I've nearly called you Arthur, which is a good sign. You've inhabited that. If you had a tash, we'd be completely gone.
Yeah, you're fixated on this tash, lad. I'm sorry, I don't have a mustache
right
now.
You haven't commented on my tash once.
And
okay?
Danny's grown her mustache.
I waxed
for
mine
you.
Today for you, okay? No one knows.
We've done this for you.
But it's a similar question for you, Anthony. Like, I wonder, when you got the script, did you feel sorry for him? Did you feel this guy's a wide boy? Like, he wants to party, he wants to enjoy himself, and yet, and it's not a spoiler because people know this, he's gay, and obviously he can't be in 1960s Dublin. What was your immediate thoughts of Arthur when you got him?
I thought he was an asshole. Immediately, I thought, this guy's awful. Aristocracy, sort of West Brit, this, just all these hot, like these sort of things that I didn't like. And then the stuff he would talk about poor people, the way he would talk about class, I thought, God, I hate this guy, and I would love to play him, because I like that kind of going to something that feels really far away from me and trying to understand.
West Brit would be far away from you.
From West Belfast, yeah, it would. And I thought, you know, this is an interesting sort of guy. And then as I read more and more, and as I started to sort of build the character, I just started to fall in love with him and feel really emotional about, like, you know, like being gay in that time, like, it was just so, it's so awful, you know, like, you would get 20 years hard labor, which was essentially just a death sentence. And that he was sort of facing that or having to lie. And the thing I really wanted to do with Arthur and Stephen and I, Stephen Knight, who wrote the show, we really wanted Arthur not to feel shame about his own sexuality, to sort of show that the world was wrong.
Yeah.
That he was like, no, this is who I am and this is fine. It's everyone else who has the problem. They're wrong, you know? And that was something that we really wanted to focus on, and that sort of made me love him.
Yeah.
And what do you want the audience to feel from it? I want the audience to love him and then hate him and then love him and then hate him, because that's how I felt playing him, and I feel like that's how he feels about himself.
Yeah, well, mission accomplished. And Danielle, you know, you mentioned a platonic relationship, and, you know, there's a phrase, a lavender marriage, I think, mm-hmm. is one way of describing it. Like, in terms of, you know, you read about these chemistry tests. Did you two guys have to do anything beforehand to have such a strong platonic relationship, if you know what I mean? Like, did you spend time hanging out to get that balance right?
No, we just got lucky, I think. We had like rehearsal time, which I think is always such a gift and not always a given. Because I think that's when you get to really like know each other and each other's processes and stuff. And Anto is just such a wonderful actor. He's a generous actor. He's really open and he loves ideas and play and he's brave. And I think I always felt very safe in the scenes with him, because if I was getting it wrong or maybe I was making mistakes or anything like that, I always knew that he had my back. So I think once you have that kind of strong relationship in the scene, you kind of, you're safe to play, safe to explore, safe to go places that you don't think you can. So yeah, I think that's where it came from, really.
And Danny made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, a lot.
Still am.
That was so good to work with Danny. She's such a legend and like so, so brilliant. And I think my favorite sort of part in the show that I have anyways is all the scenes with her. I just think they're like really, I think I act better because she's in the scenes, you know, so.
And well, sorry.
No, you go.
I was just saying it's an interesting relationship to explore as well, yeah. Because it's all, I mean, as from speaking from my perspective, you're like someone's girlfriend, someone's love interest, someone's mm-hmm. wife or something like that. And I think it's rare to be able to explore a platonic actual friendship and mm-hmm. also like such an unconventional marriage for the time. Like mm-hmm. they really are characters ahead of their time in yeah. so many ways. And yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for Un Mariage Blanc in the modern day.
Are you saying they're pioneers of poly?
I would say so. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
What's the
we owe them a lot.
Again?
Un Mariage Blanc, kind of like a white marriage, like
okay. So where did I get lavender marriage?
Lavender marriage
that's
is also
one as
the
well.
Term.
That's
yeah.
One as well, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Do
marriage
text
of convenience.
In if you know other names, marriages that involve
no riding.
Yeah.
That might be a simpler way of doing it. The wedding scene is brilliantly done because it's a platonic relationship you yeah. guys have. But I actually thought when I watched the wedding, is a twist in this going to be that they're actually going to get it on?
Wow.
Have to wait for season two, I'm afraid.
Season two?
No, I think we played around a lot with that, and that was a really fun day because
yeah.
I think they're both... like obviously Arthur is performing as a heterosexual man throughout his whole life and has that pressure. And then I think Lady Olivia is also so aware of public versus private and how she has to perform in order to get where she needs to go and succeed as a woman in society. So I think they together mm-hmm. were really enjoying the performativity of like, it's yeah. like an in-joke for them, you know, yeah. of how they're almost taking the piss out of everyone who's there. Like yeah. everyone's buying into a complete facade. So I think they really wanted to push that and yeah. play with each other and have mm-hmm. fun because they can, you know what I mean? Like there's certain privileges that wealth brings you. And I think they really enjoy that element of each other as well.
And another scene that really works, well, it all works, but the reading of the will, it's a real, and we don't want to get into too much because bombs are dropped kind of, but it's like, did you guys spend a bit of time, you and unfortunately I forget the actor's name who plays Edward, your
Louis.
Brother, Louis.
Yeah.
But did you kind of think about that one a lot because it's a real linch point in the series?
Yeah, that one for me was more just like reacting. You know, like I think sometimes you can do too much prep on things and go, well, what am I feeling beat by beat? Whereas that scene is just, I'm receiving information. I'm going into this scene going, in my head, I'm going to get a load of money. I'm going to probably just sell this company off and then go back to London and continue my life. And then suddenly all these little clauses come in, all these little beats. And I think in that scene, it's just about sort of being as relaxed as possible and just listening to the will and going, wait, what? And I let it drop in and each beat, just like see how your body naturally reacts to it.
There's a movie called Sideways, and bear with me now, and I reckon it's affected the sales of Merlot because the character played by Paul Giamatti says, I am not drinking any effing Merlot. Mm. This is probably going to increase the sales of Guinness around the world. And everyone asks, Anthony, do you drink Guinness? But they used to advertise it for pregnant women. So are you a Guinness drinker?
And are you pregnant? Is the second question.
I didn't
guys,
ask that.
You're getting
tell us by all
first.
And are you pregnant?
I am pregnant with possibility. And
with talent.
No, there was a time in my life where like if you cut me, I would have bled black for sure. Like definitely I lived on it. It was my main source of iron for my 20s, I think. But I thankfully I don't drink as much of it as I did because just can't. But yeah, like what was it? It was Guinness milk and sugar, I think, when you were younger, if you were like had an iron deficiency or something. Like
But presumably you don't actually drink any Guinness throughout the whole filming. I mean, that's all just...
Well, Anto did bring a van to the last day of rap, which was...
I brought a Guinness truck to set and got everyone hammered.
You're getting very Hollywood now.
And mate, I mean, I say Guinness truck. It was a white van with three kegs in the back of it. I don't know
what was your man's name? He was great.
Oh, your fella. He used to be a musician or something, but he's great crack. I found him on Instagram. And he came up and he was meant to come at the end of the day, but he came at lunch. So then for the rest of the day, everyone was cut.
Yeah, it was like, it was Anto's rap gift to the cast. It was really kind.
Just everyone, getting everyone drunk. And like, there's one scene in the show, you can just tell the cameraman was just hammered.
Like the fringe. I thought that was a creative choice,
it was a creative choice, but I'll take full responsibility for that.
Anthony, tell me this. There was another streamer you were on last year, Disney, with Say Nothing. Brilliant show as well. You know, you actually played, I was going to say it was a dark show. You played a character called The Dark.
Yeah.
You mentioned you were from West Belfast. Mm-hmm. Was that a big emotional commitment to get into that story?
Yeah, I mean, I had reservations taking it because no matter what sort of vantage point you tell about the Troubles, it was such a dirty, messy war. You're going to offend people and upset people. And when I heard it's Disney doing the Troubles, I thought, absolutely not. And then I read the book and thought it was amazing. And then I met with the author and the writers and the producers and stuff. And I said to them, before we do this show, we're not going to be able to like answer questions about this. We should just ask questions. Like, there's brothers who have killed each other over which splinter group of the IRA they belong to. Disney isn't going to come in and solve this. So what I wanted the show to do, and I think what the show achieved, is like, it started a lot of conversations. And it didn't try and say, these people are evil, these people are right, these people are good, these people are bad. It was just a conversation. And I was really proud to be a part of it.
Yeah, rightly so. Danielle, I was talking to Colin Farrell a little while ago, his little name drop for you. I always try and throw them in. But, you know, he said, I never stop worrying about getting the next part. And an actor never actually believes they're an actor. Like, he's still waiting to get to that point, you know? And I was telling you before we came on air, I loved you in Lakelands. Obviously, I saw you in Obituary last year. Have you got to a point where you say, this is my job now, I'm not going to have to do anything else? Are you there now in your career, now that you're on, you know, House of Guinness and something like that? Or do you understand Colin's kind of sense of where's the next job coming?
I always be worrying. Always be worrying. I think life is unpredictable. So yeah, I'm always just feel, I've gone through lots of unemployment periods in my life. And I always just feel very grateful to be doing the job that I'm doing. And I always think, like, obviously there's always days when anyone in life doesn't want to go to work, no matter what they're doing, or you're having a tough day, you can't quite get it right, you're in your head. Mm. And I always just think, like, this could be the last time that I do this. And it just, like, yeah, it makes me feel so grateful. But yeah, no, I think I'll always be worrying where the next job is coming from, for sure.
That's great, Danny. That's such a good bit of advice, like, to think this could be the last day that I get to do this.
Yeah, it could be the last time you ever get to do it, every time. And I think that it's like with theatre as well. Like, you know, I've done shows where we've done over 100 shows playing a maid, you know, that kind of way. There's only so much you can find each night. But I think, like, every time you have to act like it's the first time, and every time it has to be the first time.
Your tea, my lord?
Your tea.
Tea, my lord.
Tea? You're my lord. Oh, God. But yeah, it's a gift and a blessing, and it's really hard. And there's so many amazing, talented actors out there that that I have seen that, like, you know, some people will never know of or never know that they exist. So I think it's just, I feel very lucky to be able to do it, and it's never a given.
Well, that's a great way of putting it. I've been talking to Danielle Gallagher and Anthony Boyle, who star respectively in House of Guinness, which is now streaming on Netflix. It's lovely to meet two young actors, so articulate. And Danielle, you are going to be acting for a long time, as are you, Anthony. Shame about the moustache, but thank you for bringing yours, Danny.
Thank you so much.
Danielle Gallagher there, and Anthony Boyle, who play Lady Olivia Hedges-White and Arthur Guinness, respectively, in The House of Guinness, which is now on Netflix, all 8 episodes. I am assuming there's going to be more seasons. Up next, the much-talked-about new Paul Thomas Anderson movie, One Battle After Another. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now I wanted to talk to you about another big cinema release this week, which is, I mean, calling it The Return, he hasn't really gone anywhere, but Paul Thomas Anderson's latest film called One Battle After Another. Paul Thomas Anderson is one of the most unique directors in the world, having given us everything from There Will Be Blood, Licorice Pizza, Magnolia, Boogie Nights, and all the way back to Punch Drunk Love. His new film is getting rave reviews, but to give it the Screen Time treatment, there was only one man we could call, arts journalist and film reviewer and regular reviewer on this show, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello, sir.
John, how are you? That's a lovely introduction. Thank you.
No problem. I put the bat signal in the sky.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm going to be honest. I never lie about reading books. I have a copy of Thomas Pynchon's Vineland for about 20 years, that when I was a moody something, I considered reading it, but I've never read it. It's based on that, right?
Yeah, loosely inspired though.
Okay.
So I've never read a Thomas Pynchon novel. It's on the list of, you know, cultural things that I'll get around to, let's say. But from what I understand of, you know, if you were to take this versus Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice film, that one was sticking more closely to what, you know, Thomas's writing. But with this, it's just taking the central idea of a former revolutionary, running around basically trying to protect his daughter. But I think in the original novel, it was set between the 60s and the 80s, whereas this is set between the 90s and now. So the ideas and some of the characters and some of the traits are there, but it's very much a Paul Thomas Anderson story.
And when you say, like, we can get into the story now, but when you say a revolutionary, because I was reading this and watching clips, I haven't seen this, you know, sometimes you think of the Revolutionary War, but this, when you say he was a former revolutionary, he was what exactly?
He was a left-wing activist, basically, and part of a group who called themselves the French 75. And the French 75, their rules were a little sketchy, and the jobs that they kind of did, you know, sometimes didn't make sense. Sometimes they were robbing banks or setting off bombs outside of banks. But the message was always loud and clear with this French 75 group, which is that they were trying to basically free the US from fascists, because they're living in this fascist police state. If you can imagine, even, it's a worse America than the one that, you know, we're currently seeing on the nightly news. And they were also breaking free immigrants from military detention centers on the Mexican border. So, you know, their methods aren't always great, but they are the good guys. And this,
and just to be clear, this isn't, there wasn't actually a group called the French 75.
Oh, no. This is a complete work of fiction. Yes. But again, it's set in a version of America that you're kind of sitting there thinking to yourself, well, this looks, you know, terrifyingly familiar.
Yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio back with Paul Thomas Anderson. He's a former revolutionary. Where do we find him now?
Well, we find them in two different kind of states and within the first half an hour. So bear with me here. But Leo is basically playing a man named Bob Ferguson, who, you know, as I say, he used to mean something both to himself and also the people around him. He was part of this French 75 group. And so was a woman named Perfidia Beverly Hills. Some of the names in this thing, John. But she's played brilliantly by Teyana Taylor. And Teyana Taylor's character, Perfidia, she is the one doing most of the gun pointing. Bob is, you know, a fireworks man. He is the explosives expert. But they're actually, the two of them are lovers. So all the while they're going around, you know, trying to save America, they're also building something of a life together. And Bob, I thinks he's building maybe a different life to the one that Perfidia had in mind. These things, you know, at some point along the way, conventional structures always enter the equation, and Perfidia discovers that she's pregnant with Bob's kid. Yeah. So she's obviously in no rush to kind of stop what she's doing with the French 75. He thinks, let's hand in our revolutionary badges, let's settle down, have a family. What they don't count on, John, is an old enemy, a guy named Colonel Stephen Lockjaw, another unusual moniker. This guy's played by Sean Penn. He re-enters the picture, and he's an old enemy that, you know, they crossed paths with at a detention center. And Bob doesn't know it, but Lockjaw is infatuated with Perfidia. So an awful lot of stuff happens that I won't spoil, but let's just say that you have this unusual sequence of events where Bob is forced to rethink his living arrangements. And the film, and this is all within the first half an hour, the film jumps a decade and a half to show Bob as a, you know, a struggling single dad, spends his days drinking far too much, he's rude to everyone he meets. Although saying that, he rarely ever leaves the house. He's just this paranoid stoner. And he's doing his best, or maybe even his worst, to raise his daughter, Willa, played by Chase Infinity. She's a brilliant newcomer. And they kind of, they don't really live off the grid, but they don't really live on it either. And as I say, it's somewhere in the woods, and Bob is forever kind of talking about, you know, Lockjaw might come and get us, or, you know, some other people might come and get us the way they got your mom. Willa thinks that, you know, dad is just paranoid, but unfortunately someone does come knocking on the door at some point. And in order to protect his daughter and save his daughter, who does go missing, Bob has to remove himself from the couch. He has to put down the beer cans. He has to try and remember what he used to be like when he was with the French 75. And he also has to call up Willa's karate teacher, played by Benicio del Toro, to try and help him.
Wow. Okay. And that's all in the first half an hour or there.
Oh, that, I mean, that sounds like a lot, John, but that's the basics.
You know, that's, yeah, it's all Thomas Anderson kind of doing an action thriller.
It is. Yeah. Because I was thinking this while watching it, that, you know, it's sort of a thriller to begin with, and then, you know, stick with it for an hour, and then, you know, you start to see kind of sketches of like a contemporary Western epic. Here's good guy Bob kind of, you know, driving across the country to find his daughter. Here's bad guy Sean Penn, you know, doing some just nasty things to get his own way. But I was, then it turns into a full on actioner. So I was kind of thinking to myself, this is new territory for Anderson. You know, he's never been one to repeat himself. I mean, I don't know how you can manage to draw a line from There Will Be Blood, True to the Master, True to Licorice Pizza. Those are three, but it's a weird thing because those are three very different films, but I think you would know that they were all handled by the same guy. So this is the second Thomas Pynchon film, but as you say, his first thriller. And there's signs here, I think, that just Anderson has been really holding out on us. And I think you're going to hear a lot of people talk about a car chase in this film. And you're sitting, and you might think to yourself, I've seen every type of car chase in cinema. I've never seen anything like this. And it's so strange that in a year where Tom Cruise was hanging off the side of airplanes and, you know, swimming, you know, on the planet's deepest oceans, that a car chase in a Paul Thomas Anderson film is the most exhilarating thing that I've seen on the big screen. I won't give too much away, but it's just a car chase sequence captured across a bumpy US highway, shot from the perspective of both drivers. And I sat there the whole time wondering, how the hell did you do this, Anderson? I also, you know, was holding on to my gut because it has a sort of a roller coaster feel to it. I would encourage people to see this on the biggest screen they can find. It is actually showing on IMAX screens in cinema. That's where I saw it. That's how you should experience this car chase. The whole time I was watching this, I thought, people are going to be talking about this. And also, why has Anderson never done this kind of thing before? He's very good at it.
At doing high octane action.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, yeah, extremely okay. good at it, yeah.
Is it a car scene as good to rival The French Connection?
I think so. Yeah, wow. Yeah. It's certainly okay. It's one of the best that I've seen in a while. But at the same time, simultaneously, I think what really kept me invested, because, you know, the car chase is just phenomenal, but it's 10 minutes in a film that runs for 160-odd minutes. I think at its core, the thing that kind of kept me watching was the father-daughter story. And that's what really holds this thing together. That's what keeps you invested, because at various points, I've been seeing a lot of five-star reviews for this. I'm not fully on board with that. I think this is a great Paul Thomas Anderson film, but the narrative does slip every now and then. And I think there is a lot of sudden tonal shifts in this thing that will give you whiplash, and that might actually, you know, test your, you know, I mean, at one point in the film, you're thinking, is this a culture war satire? Because it kind of feels like it. And then later on, you're starting to think, Leo, you start to realize Leo's been in his dressing gown for this whole thing. This is a stoner film, you know? So it kind of feels like there's maybe a bit too much going on in here.
Okay. And so it's not a heavy-handed metaphor for contemporary America then?
It is and it isn't. You know, like it starts to lean into one thing and then it becomes something else. But again, it does, it sets up shop in this, as I say, this terrifyingly familiar version of America. And this is an America where just stupid, dangerous men have risen through the ranks to be in power. And it's also America where you've got lots of wealthy, toxic headbangers with ulterior motives making up all the rules. So again, you don't really need to, you know, wonder what that's like to switch on the news. And it's got this just bananas subplot where Sean Penn's character is basically hoping to secure a place in this white supremacist underground group. There is a very serious side to this. But Anderson, he kind of handles things lightly, or, you know, in the middle section when Sergio Los Benicio del Toro's character and Leonardo DiCaprio team up, Bob Ferguson, that is, you do feel that, oh, we've gone from something very serious to something quite comedic. So there's it doesn't get too weighed down.
Okay. Okay. Now, look, I was kind of half raving about Paul Thomas Anderson at the start because I do love him and he's just a unique kind of filmmaker. And as you point out, like the difference between, you know, Licorice Pizza and There Will Be Blood, and yet they're all of a type. Like he's one of the most interesting guys around. Is this a suitable entry into that pretty spectacular canon?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, if you're not familiar with Paul Thomas Anderson's work, you know, you could start here, but just don't be disappointed if you don't find anything else like it. I don't think anyone would ever be disappointed with Paul Thomas Anderson's films. I am a fan of his. Wasn't crazy about Licorice Pizza. I think I always found it difficult to kind of get behind that central relationship between Hoffman and Alan Haim's character. But I preferred this. It's flawed. Like it is flawed. But I started to kind of appreciate its flaws. And every time it did something wrong, it also did something right. I thought Johnny Greenwood's, jazzy, energetic score, that keeps the pace up. I thought the supporting turns here, especially from Chase Infinity, an actress who has never appeared in a film before, and she practically steals the show. I thought maybe there was a bit too much Sean Penn. And Leo's performance I've been sitting with for the week, and I've decided that I loved it. I was a little bit up and down for a while, but I started to kind of appreciate the fact that he's done something we've seen over the last maybe 10 to 12 years or whenever it was that The Wolf of Wall Street came about. Mm-hmm. You remember when Leo won a Golden Globe for The Wolf of Wall Street? It was for the best musical or comedy category. And he got up on stage and he thanked his fellow comedians and he laughed because it was obvious that he was just as surprised as we were that he was winning an award for a very comedic type performance. And he'd spent, you know, the first half of his career playing very serious characters. Mm-hmm. But he discovered on that film, as we all did, that he's funny. That he does have a funny bone and he has got great comic timing. And I think if you look at the performances after that, maybe push The Revenant out of the way, like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, even some of the scenes in Killers of the Flower Moon, a film that was quite serious, but that Leo sometimes had fun with. He's very good at playing an action man who is, you know, so all over the place that he's quite, you know, fun to watch. And that's what he's doing here.
Yeah. Now, I'm a big Sean Penn fan, but you're saying there's just too much of him in it?
There's a lot of him in it. And I think
unnecessarily so.
Yeah, I think it's because of the kind of performance that he's given us. You know, he's quite quite a twitchy, tetchy type, quite lizard-like, completely gross, and he does even his voice in it. It's a very disturbing turn, intentionally so. But I just found it a little bit over. I wasn't sure whether it was whether Sean Penn was being over the top or whether Anderson just showed too much of him. He plays the kind of character that if he was only on screen for a total of 10 minutes, you would come away and go, that's an incredible turn from Sean Penn. We're going to see his name in award circles. Okay. And maybe we will, but I just wasn't, I didn't love it.
I hear you. Read you loud and clear. Okay, stars time. As I say, plenty of people giving it 5. What are you going to give stars-wise to One Battle After Another, which is in cinemas from the 26th of September?
Well, I think we should give 5 stars to Leo's dressing gown in this. You know, they're totally going for the dude here. And I think it's going to make Paul Thomas Anderson enthusiasts rethink their Halloween costume plans this year. And I loved his performance. I thought he mines humor, warmth, and eccentric charm from a role that shouldn't work, but it does. And I love the fact that Anderson, after all of this time, is continuing to take risks and takes extraordinary risks to his filmmaking here, and it pays off. So it's a very strong 4 stars. It's a film with flaws. I don't quite buy into this, you know, 5-star masterpiece, there's nothing wrong with it. But I'm glad that Anderson is making films like this. And if you are going to watch it, make sure it's on the big screen.
Chris Wasser is giving 4 stars to One Battle After Another, which, as I say, is in cinemas from the 26th of September. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Bat an eyelash.
Good morning.
There are no hands on the clock.
Why?
Because they're not needed.
What time is it?
I don't remember that part. All right, let's just not nitpick over the password stuff. Look, this is Bob Ferguson, all right? You just called my house. Let's cut the... I need the rendezvous point.
What time is it?
Look, Steve Lockjaw just attacked my home. I lost my daughter. This is Bob Ferguson, you understand? Right. I don't remember any more of this code speak, all right? Let's just get on with what is the rendezvous point?
A clip there from one battle after another, which is now in cinemas. That is it for this week after a busy show, which I enjoyed thoroughly, which I hope you did too. You can listen back to this show or any shows of the last 6 years by going to newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on those platforms. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Have a safe week ahead, and I will talk to you all next week.